We'll be looking at the last seven verses, verses 24 through 30 today, to get our context. Let's read from the very beginning. Isaiah chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. Let's remember that this is God's word. Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a wine press in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, please, between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? And now, please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned, and break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold oppression, for righteousness, but behold a cry for help. Woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field till there is no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. In my hearing, the Lord of hosts said, truly, many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and a homer of seed shall yield one ephah. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night till wine inflames them. The harp and the strings, the tambourine and flute and wine are in their feasts, but they do not regard the work of the Lord, nor consider the operation of his hands. Therefore my people have gone into captivity, because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished, and their multitude dried up with thirst. Therefore Sheol has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure. Their glory and their multitude and their pomp and he who is jubilant shall descend into it. People shall be brought down, each man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Lord of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. Then the lambs shall feed in their pasture, and in the waste places of the fat ones strangers shall eat. Woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity, and sin as with a cart rope, that say, let him make speed, and hasten his work, that we may see it. And let the counsel of the Holy One of Israel draw near and come, that we may know it. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. Woe to men mighty at drinking wine. Woe to men valiant for mixing intoxicating drink, who justify the wicked for a bribe and take away justice from the righteous man. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble, and the flame consumes the chaff, so their root will be as rottenness, and their blossom will ascend like dust, because they have rejected the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. He has stretched out his hand against them and stricken them, and the hills trembled. Their carcasses were as refuse in the midst of the streets. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar, and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they shall come with speed swiftly. No one will be weary or stumble among them. No one will slumber or sleep. Nor will the belt on their loins be loosed, nor the strap of their sandals be broken. Whose arrows are sharp, and all their bows bent, their horses' hooves will seem like flint, and their wheels like a whirlwind. Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions. Yes, they will roar and lay hold of the prey. They will carry it away safely, and no one will deliver. In that day they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea. If one looks to the land, behold darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the clouds. May God give his word to our hearts. May he add his blessing to it as we read it and as we hear it preached. Well, we've been looking for some weeks now at the bad fruit that came from the vineyard. We've seen God's dismay over his pampered yet perverse vineyard. And we went through it in the exposition, and we just again read today his identification of Judah and Jerusalem as that vineyard. And we've been looking at the particular bad grapes that he gathered. Now, we will see what is to come upon the vineyard. What is to come upon Judah and Jerusalem? Now, there's something else kind of preliminarily that I want us to remember too. Let us also be remembering and realizing that in that day and in our day, all nations are under the rule of Prince Messiah. We'll be singing about that in Psalm 110 in a little bit here. We sing about that in other Psalms, particularly, well, Psalm 2, Psalm 21, Psalm 45, Psalm 72. I mean, there are a number of them that deal with this. All people and all nations must yield to Jesus Christ or face his wrath, as indeed we sing in Psalm 2. Particularly, what is the people of God in this day? It is no particular nation. It is the Church of Jesus Christ. And in this day, there is matter for us to consider here as the people of God in the New Testament Church. There is matter here for people of all societies and cultures to ponder upon as well. Now, what God is talking about bringing is what he has already mentioned in verses 5 and 6. Let's flip over a page here and look. And now, please let me tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned, and break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain on it. That is all part of the parable, we might say, that is going on in those verses. It is in the very next verse that God explains the literal meaning. And now we see the working out of verses 5 and 6 there, the literal working out of the judgment to come. The first thing we need to note is in verses 24 and 25, and that is the demise of the vineyard, as God does what he talked about there in verses 5 and 6, and we sing about that sometimes in Psalm 80 as well. We start out then as the fire devouring the stubble. Now, perhaps you've seen a fire in a wheat field, particularly after the wheat's been gathered, and all that's left is the stubble. The grain heads have been taken off, the combine's gone through, everything's cut down, and so the grain heads are gone. Most of the length of the straw is gone. It's a fairly short amount of straw there, several inches tall. And all you need is a nice dry summer, especially around here where we have winter wheat, not spring wheat. And the wheat is cut in late June. And when we get to the dry days of July, the dog days of summer in July and August, if it's a little windy and it's a little dry and somebody is careless and a fire gets lit, it just races right through. Now, someone might think, oh, well, in a big, big field, there are millions, millions of little stalkettes left over from the wheat. And just one fire. Millions against one. Oh, surely they'll smother the fire. Well, of course not. Of course not. What a ridiculous thought. The millions get gobbled up by the flames. And if the local fire department doesn't get there, if the brush truck doesn't get there, it will go on and take out everything until it can find nothing else to combust. Maybe it's a great big single section field, bound on all sides by a roadway. That may stop it with the roads working as a fire break, but that's it. That's all that's going to stop it. The wheat stubble itself will not. No matter how populous it seems to be, if we call it that. No matter how strong the numbers might seem. And that is the picture here of the destruction about to come. Now, it's interesting in the Hebrew here, we don't quite have a literal translation. The literal would be, and let me see in the notes here in my New King James if they do have it. Yes, they do. I have a little note here. Therefore, as the fire devours the stubble, the note has it, a tongue of fire. And here, it's kind of a word picture. It's almost kind of poetic. The tongue is eating up. The tongue of fire is eating up the stubble field. Flame is consuming the chaff. Maybe some of the trash that came out the back of the combine is left there. Well, no, it wouldn't be back in Isaiah's day, no combines then. But a picture of the chaff that is the outer hull on the wheat seeds, on the wheat berries, burning up. That stuff will flash pretty quickly too. And all the dust that is left and all. Why, it will almost flash, won't it? All of this is devoured. Nothing stands before the flame. The judgment is further lined out in a picture of another kind of plant, perhaps a grapevine. How appropriate. We move from a grain field, wheat or barley, to a grapevine. Now, I don't know how many of you folks have vines, but we do. And we have seen when the vine has rot going on down at the root, and it dies off. That's the picture here. It's cut off from nourishment, cut off from any life, and it dies. And what's left? Well, it's not luxuriant growth. What's left is dry, brown, dead sticks. That's all there are. No matter how long they lived, no matter how much fruit they've had in the past, these vines are dead. And you can break off the stems. The other picture here is of the little blossoms. And again, don't know how many of you have grapevines, but in the springtime when they set the blossoms that will later, God willing, become the grapes, little tiny white flowers, at least in the Concord grapevines that we have, little tiny flowers, and they smell kind of pretty. And later on the grapes come from them, but not if somehow the root rots and it all dies. Then the leaves all, they shrivel up. And the flowers, why, just as we are reading here, they turn into like dust. And the dust is going up, you know, blown along by a drying hot wind. That is the picture here of what is to happen with Judah. This is what God would be bringing upon the false professing people. And this is the end of all false believers. Crunchy, brown deadness. They had a reputation for life. And at the time that God was telling this to the people of Judah through Isaiah, they seem to be strong. This may well have been written during the reign of King Uzziah, the leper king, who had been used by God to bring great military power and ability back to the land of Judah. They were becoming a power again, it seemed, and they seemed to be living. But because of their sin, deadness would come upon them. Deadness from within. The judgment that he will bring, and God is not being terribly specific just yet, is so fearsome that the hills and mountains tremble before it, as we see here in verse 25. The hills tremble. We sang about that, of course, as we opened worship today in Psalm 114. This may be referring to the earthquake that happened in Isaiah's time during Uzziah's reign, or at least looking toward it in a way. But in any case, God's destruction, God's anger, comes upon them, and he strikes them. By the blow, the hills are shaking. It's almost like a picture of jello, you know, on a plate, shaking in that way. And what is left? Not a multitude of people, but dead bodies lying around. And in Hebrew, it's very graphic. They are as manure in the streets. I could be a little more coarse yet to get the picture to you, but I think I shall forbear. In any case, we note the hand of God, the arm of God. Where have we seen that before? Well, in a number of places we've seen that. I think particularly, most frequently from us, or for us, it's from Psalm 98, verse 1. We sing that in Psalm 98 using version A or version B. And there it is a picture of God protecting his people. There is God's might and power in the covenant of grace extended in protection, extended against the enemies of his people. He, in that picture in Psalm 98, is mighty. That's what we're supposed to see with his hand and his arm. And by the way, children, let's make it clear here. This is only kind of a figure of speech. God does not have hands or arms like we do. In fact, maybe some of you have learned your children's catechism anyway. God is a spirit. Jesus taught that in John chapter 4, verse 24. God is a spirit and has not a body like men. Well, why does the Bible talk about him with an arm and a hand? Because we're supposed to understand by this that God works powerfully. And just as we get things done, children, with our arms and with our hands, maybe you children have watched your father making something with his hands. Or maybe you've watched your mother kneading bread and bringing forth a yummy smelling and a yummy tasting loaf of bread from the oven. We do things with our hands and our arms. And that's what we're to understand here. God's power, normally being used to protect his people and being used to smash his enemies. However, sadly and frighteningly, we see his hand and his arm extended against those who claim to be his people. His hand and arm are now stretched forth to do ill to Judah and Jerusalem. By the way, let us understand, folks, that when evil happens, that is not outside of the will of God. Even when hard things happen to believers, that is not something outside the will of God. I know I've mentioned this a zillion times, but let's get it talked about again. How back 34 years ago, plus change, in April of 1974, there was a terrible set of tornadoes that came through Kentucky, up through Cincinnati, up through Xenia. And the very next Sabbath day, I heard of a minister saying, this was not the will of God. What a foolish idea, and what a frightening idea. When you think about it, what a frightening idea. that whether things like this are out of God's control. If this man were right, it's absolutely useless to pray that God would protect you, because these are out of his control. They just happen. It's absolutely useless to look to him for protection if this guy was correct. Well, but he isn't. No, even disasters that happen to nations are the hand and the will of God. And difficulties and problems and afflictions that happen to believers, they are from the hand of God. You believers, though, receive these hard things not as punishment, for all your punishment has fallen upon Jesus at the cross. It may feel the same, but there is an entirely different intent from your Father in heaven than punishment, the judicial result of your sin. If you be in Jesus Christ, what you're receiving, though it feels the same as punishment, is discipline. And it is to the end that you will be more godly and more glorifying to your Father in heaven. Well, that was a little bit of an aside there. But his right hand of victory, his mighty hand and his right arm of victory, are now stretched forth to do ill to Judah and Jerusalem. And that he has done in the picture that we have here through verse 25. But verse 25 ends in a frightening way. For all this, that is, the fire going through the stubble, the flame going through the chaff, the rotting of the root, the destruction of the blossoms, for all that, oh yes, and for the trembling of the mountains and the dead bodies lying around, for all that, we might think, oh, surely that's enough. Surely the people have been punished. Surely what is remaining of the remnant of the people of God have been disciplined enough. No, no. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. And now we come to a more specific threatening of judgment upon the people should they not return, and that is armies from afar. We see that in these last five verses, 26 through 30. Again, let us remember, King Jesus reigns. He does now, and he did back then. He reigns over all things. He is not the king merely of believers. Now, surely he is that. We are people of his special kingdom. But he has a general kingdom as well. We are part of his kingdom of grace, but he has a kingdom of his glory over all the world. He reigns over all, even though they be in rebellion against them. He rules over them and uses them for his holy purposes, though they themselves mean to do no such thing. And so here is how he will bring judgment upon this vineyard that has served him so ill. First of all, figuratively speaking, he lifts the colors. Okay, now you children may wonder what in the world I'm talking about there. He takes a big flag, that's what the picture is here, and jams it into the ground. And it's a great big flag that can be seen from far away. And the enemy soldiers are to come to that. That's what we mean by lifting the colors, raising a standard, right? If you have been children to one of our Boy Scout courts of honor, we have a flag ceremony, and we have the raising of the colors, all right? The American flag and our troop flag and all that. Or maybe you've been to some other ceremony where such is done, but that is the picture here. Of a flag for everyone to come to rally around and be ready for battle. But not only that, he whistles for them, for them to come. Some of you will remember I used to carry a whistle with which I would get the attention of my sons when they were little. They wouldn't particularly pay attention to my voice, but they'd sure come running when they heard the whistle. And maybe you have had parents who were able to whistle even better just with your fingers, or with their fingers, rather. And they called to you. I know that my mother has spoken of the fact that she and her two older sisters really had no excuse for getting home in time, because my grandfather, who had learned how to do this in World War I, had such a whistle could be heard over most of their village. And they couldn't claim, "Oh, I didn't hear you, Daddy." He knew very well they could hear. Here we see God whistling, King Jesus whistling to call them. And these come across from all the world. Just as we call the dog or call our kids across a wide field or from down the street. And they come. They do come to King Jesus' call. As we read here, they come swiftly. They don't dawdle around. They come determinedly. They're not coming in a lazy fashion. They're not coming thinking, "Well, this is no big deal." They're coming very, very determinedly. None of them are weary, that is, tired children. None of them stumbles. Nobody slumbers or sleeps. And they come without anything to stop them. You know, here's a picture, perhaps, of somebody having a belt snap and their pants fall down. Well, they can't come. Or their shoelace snaps and they can't come. But none of that will happen when King Jesus calls them. Not only that, they come with deadly power. Their arrows aren't dull, they are sharp. Their bows are ready to go. And their horses' hooves are strong and hard. Back in these days, horses weren't shoed or shod. There's a good use of the word shoeing. Maybe you children haven't heard that past tense version before, to be shod. You know, I have shoes on. Can you see? So I am shod. Isn't that interesting? And now you can thrill all your friends and thrill your parents with using this old-fashioned past tense of shoe. But in any case, the horses are not shod, and in those days, a horse would not be very good if it had soft hooves. But these horses aren't that way. They are not stopped by lameness. And their wheels, that is, the wheels of their chariots, they whirl like a whirlwind. These aren't weaklings. And they're not coming unprepared. No, they're ready to do God's task, ready to bring judgment upon this wicked vineyard. God compares them here to ravening and ravenous lions. Have you children ever seen a lion, a real lion? Maybe you've gone down to the Columbus Zoo and seen one. Well, I can tell you, you don't want to try to play with them. Out in the wild, they would roar just as they are about to catch you. And they have terrible sharp claws, terrible sharp teeth, strong paws that those claws are in, strong jaws and mouths that those teeth are in. Have you ever, children, watched a cat having caught a mouse? Or have you ever watched a terrier dog with a rat? How it grabs it with its teeth and shakes its whole head, shakes the rat or the cat, the mouse to pieces, tears it apart, toys with it, but just rips it to shreds before eating it. And that is the picture here. Tearing, slashing, killing, and destroying. What if you had a bunch of mice and just one cat? Could all the rest of the mice rescue the one, perhaps, that the cat took? Of course not. Of course not. The cat would grab it and crush it in its mouth, tear it with its claws, and take it back, maybe, to where it could eat in peace. And that is the picture here. carrying off with no deliverance possible. And then in a very elegant way, Isaiah moves from the roaring of lions to the roaring of the sea. An overwhelming, swamping, drowning roar of the ocean. I wonder how many of you that have computers, how many of you that have the internet, have watched videos that people took of the great tsunami from about 2 years ago out in the Indian Ocean. It is frightening to watch. As all this water comes surging in and just carries all before it, and there is no hope, no hope for those caught in it. Why, they may try to hold on to something. They may try to run away, but in it comes, and the water grabs them. And they're sucked back out to sea, perhaps never to be seen again. Certainly never to be seen again alive. That is what this destruction from afar will be like. So, when did this happen for Judah and Jerusalem? Well, even as Isaiah was writing this, they had recently been warned with the earthquake, and later on, when Isaiah was a much older man, in the days of King Hezekiah, they were warned far more stronger when the Assyrians nearly overwhelmed them. They were warned with great defeat later on, after Isaiah's time, in the days of King Jehoiakim, with defeat by the Babylonians, and shortly afterward, the kingdom of Judah was destroyed. The people weren't, but they were carried off for a time at 587 BC by the Babylonians. Now, after a couple of generations, they were allowed back. But then finally, after the Jews, after the people as a whole rejected Jesus, in a generation, they were destroyed by many nations coming in under the leadership of Rome in AD 70. So what is God referring to? I would say all of these to some degree, with them culminating in the destruction in AD 70. For we read there that they will lay hold of the prey here in verse 29. They will carry it away safely, and no one will deliver. There was deliverance after the Babylonian captivity from the Persians. Persians under Cyrus came, and they delivered the Jews. But no one has yet, sadly, delivered the Jews from what happened to them under the Roman Empire these nearly 2,000 years ago. None has come and none shall until the day that Jesus brings them, as we read in Romans 11, to look upon him and live. Now, what about the people who were truly the people of God, the remnant that God often speaks of through Isaiah and other prophets? Let's be sure that through this all, the true people of God were kept safe and secure, although thousands fell around them, such as we sing about in Psalm 91. Well, you sang this last week in the Psalm meditation, verses 7 and 8. And so it is today. Nations who rebel against the Lord and his Christ shall be destroyed. We sing about that in Psalm 2. They shall be destroyed unless they look to the man of Jehovah's right hand and yield to him, such as we sing often in Psalm 80. It is only then that there should be deliverance, but certainly then there should be deliverance. What's going on then with all the problems and all the upheaval going on in our land and around the world today? Well, we don't know if this means one thing or another, but we do know, friends, that there is much wickedness in our land. And we do know that Jesus shall be clearing it out. What shall come in the near future, we do not know. But We do know that rebellion should be destroyed. We do know that all working against Jesus Christ should be destroyed. We do know that someday the gospel shall triumph throughout all the world, and Jesus shall come again to crown all things. The wickedness in the world should be destroyed, but you, his people, should be upheld, even through bank collapses, even through commodity dislocations, even through the threats of nuclear and biological warfare. You shall be preserved through it all. You shall be brought to safety to your own place in your Father's household above. Wickedness shall be destroyed, but the people of God shall be upheld, as we just looked at in Psalm 91 last week, and as we saw in Psalm 92 today. In all this, King Jesus is ruling. King Jesus is bringing all things under his sway. King Jesus is triumphing. Amen. We'll sing now from Psalm 50, portion C. This is a warning. A warning to those who claim to be the people of God, but who aren't really. This would have been profitable for the people of Isaiah's time to listen to. These who are bringing forth the bad grapes of nastiness and sin. Let us take to heart ourselves what these words are, and let us make sure that we are not the wicked ones who dare to take his covenant, God's covenant, in our mouths. Let us be rather the ones that remember God, the ones that look to Jesus and in him live. Psalm 50, portion C.